I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. Today is Memorial Day, and we will be talking about mourning and organizing, grieving and agitating, addressing military and capitalist attacks on life and land, people and planet, confronting loss and soldiering on. Memorial Day commemorations were begun after the Civil War by African Americans in Charleston, South Carolina, who led the first interracial ceremony of Cemetery Decoration Day, 3 years before the federal government recognized Decoration Day, and over 100 years before the holiday was officially renamed Memorial Day. Today, in Portland, we honor those fallen in other battles, including Rick Best and Talishan Namkai Mesha, who died this weekend standing up to white supremacist violence on TriMet. And we honor the survivors of such battles, like Micah Fletcher, also wounded in the same incident. If you, too, would like to stand up to fascism, but more safely in a big crowd of anti-fascist folks, then you can come on June 4th, on Sunday, to City Hall, Terry Schrunk Plaza, Chapman Park Square, downtown Portland, from 12 to 5, 12, 12:30. Get there midday, just get downtown. Be anti-fascist. This Memorial Day, we will be discussing different forms of soldiering and of dealing with loss. We start with Jan Hocken talking with Jakob Reisberg, an attorney who just returned to Portland after doing legal work in North Dakota with the National Lawyers Guild for activists arrested at Standing Rock. They'll discuss how activists are continuing to organize in inspiring ways and how legal teams coming in are learning to work in support of tribal communities, even as people are dealing with tremendous grief and mourning. Bill Resnick will be here with an interview with John Pfeffer about the Trump administration's foreign policy and intensified imperial outreach and the encouraging of arms races around the globe. They'll consider the increased death, misery, looting, and climate catastrophe that that entails and how to respond. Erstwhile Mole Norm Diamond will interview Kari Marie Norgaard, Associate Professor of Sociology and Environmental Studies at the University of Oregon, author of Living in Denial, Climate Change, Emotions, and Everyday Life. They'll discuss climate change unresponsiveness, the phenomenon of people aware of the issue's seriousness, but who nevertheless don't act on their awareness. And then Norm will be continuing that conversation with Jan Hocken. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show and its segments in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm/program/old-mole-variety-hour. We invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow at Old Mole on Twitter. If you're interested in getting involved with the Mole, or if you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at Old Mole Variety Hour, all one word, at gmail.com. We turn now to Jan Hocken and Jakob Reisberg discussing legal support and Standing Rock.
Welcome to KBOO, Jakob Reisberg.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you've most recently worked as a legislative legal advisor for the New York City Council and were active as a law student around a number of social justice issues, including racism and police violence. More recently, this year, you worked to provide criminal defense representation in North Dakota for the Water Protector Legal Collective. And so we look forward to hearing a report on that work. First, why don't you explain a bit about the Water Protector Legal Collective, what they do and how they were formed?
Sure. So the Water Protector Legal Collective was formerly known as Red Owl, and it's been a couple different things at different times. So for a while, the Water Protector Legal Collective was the sort of group of lawyers who were in camp at Standing Rock while the camps were still standing and populated and hadn't been evicted by the police. And at that point, they were doing things like providing jail support or providing training, providing help for folks to give them information about what to do if they were arrested. Now that camps have been evicted, it's sort of shifted to a slightly different mode. Now the Water Protector Legal Collective has a civil branch which is working to bring civil claims on behalf of water protectors to try to get some repents for excessive use of force, things like that. I didn't work with that arm. I instead worked with the criminal defense branch. And there, the mission is to provide free legal support for anyone who's facing criminal charges for their activism at Standing Rock.
And the stakes are higher and consequences more daunting. So would you set the scene for us of what it was like there at Standing Rock when you arrived? Clearly, there's much to mourn in the loss of the losses of the protests and the pipeline being completed and on one level kind of rolling over that brave and important protest and also how much it inspired people around the world. But there's a lot still standing at Standing Rock. And what was the situation? What was the scene when you arrived?
So I got there. I it certainly was inspiring, and it was inspiring enough for me to quit my job in New York and move out to North Dakota. And I got there in March, about a month after the final eviction. The final eviction in camp was in late February when the National Guard and police finally said to everyone who was still there, you have to leave or we're going to arrest you, and that's what they did. But when I got there to a situation where, despite the fact that folks were no longer in camp, despite the fact that the pipeline was completed and that oil began to flow basically in the first month that I was there, the state of North Dakota was still pursuing criminal charges, criminal cases against a large number of water protectors, over 850 separate cases by the time that I got there.
And these were arrests that had happened last fall. Some of them were mass arrests. And over a period of several months. Can you say something about those arrests?
Absolutely. I mean, there were sort of waves of arrests happening from the very beginning of the start of the resistance at Standing Rock to the very end. And sometimes it would be one or two a day, just sort of individual folks picked off by the police. On certain days, there were these huge mass arrests with sometimes groups of 20, 30, up to 130 people being arrested all at once.
And recently, some of those cases have been thrown out by the judge because they don't meet, I assume, the normal requirements of the law. Can you say a little about that? And what is there a different bar for these? Clearly, these are political arrests, and there is both the demonstration of their power on the scene and the discourse around it, but then they may have a different fate in the courts.
Absolutely. And I think it might be helpful if I read to you an arrest report, which is pretty representative of, I think, a lot of these mass arrests. This is an arrest report written by a police officer of my client, who I won't name, but I'll just refer to her as grandmother. She's a woman in her 70s who's a Native woman with family from South Dakota. And this is the entirety of the basis for her arrest. So grandmother was in a teepee on a DAPL site. Grandmother was arrested for criminal trespass and inciting a riot after refusing to leave. Grandmother and others locked arms together to delay being arrested. There were well over 200 people at the unlawful protest. And that's it. That's the entire basis that the police officer states for arresting this person. And then that's the basis that the prosecutor then decides, yes, I'm affirmatively going to continue to bring criminal charges against these people.
So the prosecutor used that police report to move it forward to criminal charges. And clearly, there's both the arrogance of the arresting officer, but then the prosecutor can decide, right? There's a lot of latitude in whether to press criminal charges. And that seems like quite a cynical, as well as an arrogant and oppressive move.
It's hard to understand from the perspective of someone who sort of sees what happened at Standing Rock as a righteous cause, as a righteous resistance. I asked, and several of our attorneys asked the prosecutor at various stages, why are you doing this? And the response was, my community was terrorized. And I think that that's a truthful statement from his perspective, but it sort of shows you how wide the gap is between where we're coming from.
Yeah, and how elastic the term terrorism is. And there's a long history of that, of one person's social justice movement resistance is another's act of terrorism. What about the deal now that these protesters are being offered? Because, of course, the courts often offer pleas, and that itself is something we followed on the show over time, the corrupting aspect of all these pleas. What pleas are being offered the protesters?
So essentially the same exact plea is being offered in almost every case. The prosecutor has said to water protectors, if you don't want to come back to North Dakota, if you want to settle this right now, we will let you take sort of the charge of your choice and give you what's called a deferred imposition of a sentence, which means so long as you are not arrested or potentially convicted in the next year, this charge will vanish in a year. So it's as if nothing had ever happened, but the state of North Dakota will keep your bond money as fines and fees. So depending on what you were bonded out for, the state of Dakota keeps that money. So there's both a financial incentive for the state and the prosecutors to be pushing these deals, but there's also a sort of narrative, control of the narrative or control of some sort of potentially moral victory that's at stake there, where if folks take that deal and say, yes, I'm guilty, and I had a lot of clients who basically said, I'm never going to say that because I don't believe I was guilty of anything. But from the state of North Dakota's perspective, they then get to claim, look, these folks admitted to committing a crime, therefore our use of force was justified, and therefore, importantly, they can't sue us down the road for whatever civil claims they want to bring.
So what are the stakes for the defendants in these criminal cases, which some of which are felonies and serious, some have federal charges that involve very serious federal cases? Can you say something about the different stakes for the protesters who've been filed under criminal charges?
Absolutely, although I want to then mention something about felonies, because that term sometimes has scary connotations, and I think it's important to take a closer look of what that actually means. Of the 850 cases I mentioned, only 50 or so of those are felony cases. The rest are all misdemeanors, things like trespass, things like refusing to follow a safety order, things of that nature, so relatively low stakes. Felonies do have sort of inherently higher stakes because of some of the collateral consequences that they can have. But if you actually look at what the underlying actions are that the state is alleging constitute those felonies, it becomes a lot less scary. And I think it's useful to try to interrogate why the word felony sort of conjures up scary thoughts for most people. But for example, the most recent felony case that just went to trial a few days ago was a case in which an individual was flying a drone above a resistance site and sort of monitoring with the drone what the police were doing, filming what was going on, doing documentary filmmaking. And this individual was charged with felony reckless endangerment for flying the drone. And the accusation was, he was flying in a way that could be extremely dangerous.
So what is the Water Protector Legal Collective position on this, just in closing, and then maybe just say a bit about some of the other activism going on around these legal cases in closing today, and we'll continue to follow this going forward.
Our position is that all of these cases should be dismissed, and this drone case that I mentioned actually was given not guilty on all counts, so that's a good outcome there. Going forward, we are looking for legal support and assistance. So especially if there are any attorneys, paralegals, or just sort of eager volunteers, if you want to look at our Facebook or website, you can just Google Water Protector Legal. We also have a companion organization called the Freshet Collective that's doing amazing legal support work and support work for arrestees. So look them up as well. I think they're hiring too.
Well, thank you, Jakob Reisberg, for your work and for joining us here today on the Old Mole Variety Hour. And we look forward to continuing to support it whatever way we can, and including periodic field reports. Thanks so much
thank
for being
you.
With us.
Through our voice, the world knows there's no choice. We're begging, save the children, the little ones who just don't understand. Give them a chance to breathe their young and help purify the land. People hear us, through our voice, the world knows there's no choice.
Thank you, Jan Hocken and Jakob Reisberg. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. Coming up later on today's show, we'll hear from Associate Professor of Sociology and Environmental Studies, Kari Marie Norgaard, as well as Norm Diamond and, again, Jan Hocken, about the people who have not gone to Standing Rock, about why people fail to act on the climate catastrophe that is already in progress. But first, we'll hear from Bill Resnick and his guest, John Pfeffer, about how the Trump administration is working to create more dead people to be commemorated on Memorial Day. Bill?
Hello. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole. Hi, John Pfeffer. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, great. John Pfeffer edits the online journal Foreign Policy and Focus for the Institute for Policy Studies. He writes a great deal of books and many op-ed style articles that address the great issues facing the world. His recent books include Aftershock, A Journey into Eastern Europe's Broken Dreams, and the book we'll discuss today, Splinterlands. It's set in the year 2050, which is not what so many dystopian writers have feared, a brave new world, totalitarian consolidation of power. Rather, 2050 in Splinterlands is the disintegration of all countries and blocs, and thus the end of the capacity to stop a relentless global warming that even now is undermining the ecosystems on which human life depend. So, John Pfeffer, tell us about the coming of Splinterlands. Then we can talk about how this absolute catastrophe, perhaps human extinction, can be avoided. First, though, what is Splinterland and why is it so likely?
Well, I began Splinterlands before the Brexit vote in the UK, the United Kingdom deciding to leave the European Union. And I wrote it also before the election of Donald Trump. But I imagine that these trends, which have come to pass, would only intensify between now and 2050. In other words, as you said, these larger blocks of nations like the European Union and multi-ethnic countries like the United States and Russia and China would begin to fragment, in part because of growing nationalism, in part because of growing economic inequality and political discontent, and of course as well because of climate change and increased competition for diminishing resources. Unfortunately, we have seen already since I finished the manuscript and since it was published an intensification of these trends, and so we are seeing the European Union begin to fragment, the transatlantic alliance in the wake of Donald Trump's recent visit to Europe begin to fragment. We have seen as well countries facing stronger movements for self-determination or for greater autonomy, whether it's in Myanmar or the Philippines or even in Saudi Arabia, where there is a Sunni-Shiite divide. So this is the coming of the Splinterlands, and I kind of project that into 2050, and I parallel a story of a scholar who is trying to understand not only the fragmentation of the international community, but the fragmentation of his own family.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about Splinterlands. You write about the secession of the privileged and the elites, and in fact the military forces that they can assemble to protect themselves. That looks awfully like a variety of countries today that are failed states, that is, little fiefdoms now run by people with powerful militaries, or powerful enough militaries, and of course having to fight one another. You see that kind of failed state coming to, and it's indeed quite possible within, certainly in China and Russia, and in the U.S. also.
Unfortunately, I mean, of course, right now what we see are gated communities, and those gated communities have varying levels of security depending on the wealth of the people inside the gated community. You also see a new trend, not only survivalists who kind of create their own armed compound, but actually extremely wealthy survivalists, people who are dot-com billionaires, who are spending enormous amount of money to kind of create their own armed compounds. And they have enough money to hire their own private security forces. Now, at the moment, that exists within democratic societies or within relatively cohesive societies. But as wealth begins to divide, as we have growing economic inequality, and as we have greater competition for a smaller pie of resources, then I'm afraid you're going to see the wealthy acquire more and more firepower to hold on to what they have or to get even more. And that's where I see a potential trajectory for even democratic countries like the United States.
Yeah, and it does seem to me that that's quite possible in view of the fact that climate change it's going to have variable consequences across the globe. Some countries are going to be absolutely devastated, as in most of the South or much of the Middle East, where people are going to be fleeing. That is, those who can, and the others are going to be dying miserable deaths. But places like the United States, there are areas like the Southeast that are going to collapse. But there are areas like Cascadia, where we live in Oregon, that will still have a productive agriculture and be fairly productive. And those societies, it's not inconceivable. In fact, it's quite possible that the wealthy of those, let's say of Cascadia, will in fact barricade themselves against the rest of the country and world and try and survive. That's part of your vision, and it seems to me quite possible.
Well, it's part of my nightmare. It's part of what
I'd like to see. Yes.
And I mean, right now, when we talk about climate change, we largely talk about the disappearance of relatively small islands, Maldives, Seychelles, etc. And while the disappearance of those societies is unquestionably tragic, the scale of refugee flows is relatively small. But when we start talking about the potential disappearance of cities like Tokyo, Shanghai, Seoul,
New York, Miami,
exactly.
You know,
then we're talking
Long Island.
About enormous. Yes. Enormous refugee flows. And where are those folks going to go? And you're right. There's going to be not only a competition over, you know, resources like energy, but there'll be competition for actual space, for just living space.
Right. This is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Listener supported. Beholden to no one, independent. In fact, looking to that better possible democratic and sustainable world. I'm talking to John Pfeffer. He's the author of Splinterland and quite a few books, and he writes a lot. His blog is wonderful, particularly his analysis of the Trump administration now. We've been talking about one of the possible worlds in 2050, which is the subject of Splinterlands, a novel, and it's the breakdown, the disintegration of the world system, and therefore the incapacity of any group to stop global warming, which is on the way to could in fact lead to human extinction. It might be avoided. You write some in the book. You point out, well, if we had done this and if we'd have done that, what do you see as the possibilities of now avoiding splinterlands and doing it quickly?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously we need more international cooperation at this point, not less international cooperation. I'm hopeful that maybe we've reached a kind of high water mark in terms of far right wing populism in Europe, and that the European Union is going to survive this particular test, and that the European Union can kind of continue to lead the way along with several other countries around the world on the question of climate change. Of course, we have to do far more than what the Paris Agreement stipulates. As long as we can survive the next 3+ years here in the United States under Donald Trump, I'm hoping that we can, you know, put forward not only a kind of status quo ante, you know, the situation before Trump came to power, but actually a much better governance system here, better candidates, a better approach to dealing with international questions that embeds the United States in a cooperative way with countries around the world to tackle the most important issues. Climate change, of course, is number one, but we also have to deal with questions like pandemics, economic inequality, obviously still trans-border conflicts. So building up that question, that elusive quality of solidarity within a country and across borders is critical to avoiding this nightmare scenario of the splinterlands.
Yeah, unfortunately, my sense is, as you're like talking about Europe, the people running Europe, the sort of neoliberal elites of finance and capital, they don't seem to want to bend at all. They're ready to, in fact, extract the last bit of bounty as they can from the working classes of Europe. And that runs really radically against the possibilities of a decent European Union, you know, relatively democratic, like the United States, which is even less democratic. How do we deal with that? And we only really have a minute. Well, we'd have to talk about this again. It seems to me we're running into the power of concentrated wealth and capital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I mean, the leadership of the European Union at this point doesn't realize that the EU will only survive if it changes dramatically, if it becomes more accountable to its own citizens, and if it becomes, again, committed to what it was committed to at the beginning, which is equitable distribution of wealth within the greater European Union. That's a challenge the Europeans themselves have to engage in. There's precious little we can do right now at the moment in the United States under Donald Trump, but I'm hoping in 3+ years, or even after the midterm elections, we can kind of repair transatlantic relations and push for a more equitable European Union.
Yeah, John, we have to leave, but we could talk about this again. It seems to me there are things that we can do now, but we'd have to talk about them and at least create models and create an alternative and create a really contending left that the Democratic Party is not. Anyway, that's my last word. Sorry, John, I think you probably agree. In any event, thanks a lot for talking to us. And Splinterlands is really a good read, too, and it's not long, and it lays out really those possibilities so vividly. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns jammed downtown. The killing clowns, the blood money men. The shooting foes. Washington bullets again. As every cell in Chile will tell.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. You can find links to our music choices and links to all our segments, including the preceding interview with Bill Resnick and John Pfeffer, on our KBOO webpage in a day or two. And you can share those links from our Facebook page or via Twitter. You can get in touch with us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Finally, on this Memorial Day, we turn to two conversations about why more of us don't do something before there's no one left to have a memorial. Norm?
Thank you, Fran. Climate change is a deadly serious topic, deadly serious, potentially deadly for our species. That's you and me, sisters and brothers, for our children, potentially for our homeland, for the planet. You'd think that sounding the alarm, giving more information, would mobilize people, would activate people. Or would you? Is giving information, is hitting that toxin so that people are aware of the problems, is that sufficient? Does that accomplish mobilizing people? Longtime activists know that getting people to act is much more complicated than getting the information out there. In fact, indications are, around climate change, that the more information we put out, the less people are likely to act. Is it a question of the kind of information? Well, what then does it take? What then would it take to enable people to mobilize around the issue of climate change? If it's not a lack of awareness, and there is widespread awareness, why the inactivity? This morning we'll have a two-part discussion addressing precisely that issue. We'll speak first with a sociologist, then with a psychologist. The two of them have a lot in common beyond the happy coincidence of Norwegian roots. Both of them are more than scholars. They're profound scholars thinking deeply around these issues, but they take their scholarship, they take their theorizing out into the community. They're activists as well. Kari Marie Norgaard. Kari, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Kari is the author of Living in Denial, Climate Change, Emotions, and Everyday Life. She's a professor at University of Oregon, both in sociology and environmental studies. She's with us this morning, not only to talk about climate change, but because that fascinating book that I just mentioned raises larger political questions. And she's carried her concern around inactivity, people knowing something but not acting, even though they know it's important, to other areas as well, to human rights violations, for instance. That is, people aware of human rights violations on the part of their government, but choosing, I don't know if choosing is the right word, but looking the other way, not fully taking it in, not fully acting. Kari, knowing the need, let's stick with climate change for the moment, knowing the need to take action, why aren't many more people active?
Thank you, Norman. Thanks for that really generous introduction and for the work that all of you are doing on this show. So that's a really big question on the lips of many people in the scientific community for a long time, which is how I got interested in doing the work I did. But also, obviously, all of us who are watching what's happening around climate change and looking around and saying, what's going on? Here's this really big problem. It's, you know, barely made it now in the last couple cycles as a presidential election, but for a long time, you know, was very low on the public lists of priorities and things like that. And I think, you know, essentially my work has come, which is rooted in psychology and social psychology in particular, is coming at this, again, as you said, you know, information is important, but information alone is not enough. And the dominant view or sort of, and still from a lot of the scientific community is, you know, we need to do better science communication, or people get very discouraged and they say, oh, you know, people just don't care. And my work is really trying to change, widen the response to that question, that either people don't know or they don't care. And on the don't know side, exactly right. You can't just give people information. And it's great that you mentioned the organizing dimension of this, because organizers have known this for a long time. But we have to have a sense that there's something worthwhile and meaningful that we can actually do in order to be involved. We also have to have a sense that there's other people, you know, and in this case, because it's such a large, complex problem, we're aware that doing something on our own is not adequate. So especially if you look at, you know, the lack of social movement response and things like that, it can be kind of circular. We know we need to have a lot of people involved. If we look around and see there aren't very many, then why bother? And especially, too, we have a context where we're told, you know, respond to climate change by, you know, doing smaller individual actions, which are important but are not going to stop climate change, you know, like using more energy efficiency or not using automobiles. These things matter, but we, at this point, have to be talking about much larger political scale change, changes in our fuel sources, getting off of coal, thinking at the state and national level about policies, not at the individual level. So in the absence of that larger discourse, people are likely not to be involved either. I can say more, but I'll let you.
Yeah. Well, implicit in what you're saying, of course, is the need to extend that discourse to have much more conversation about the issues. If we're going to make
exactly.
an argument,
I think we need to have, you know, the last two conversations were very interesting and related to this kind of thing, because on the one hand, there's a lot of discouragement, and I think there's a lot of discouragement, particularly in the middle class, and that can be a very cyclical thing, because, you know, if there's anything that will keep the power structure in place, it's if those of us who do still have some political power don't use it. Right? By contrast, if we look at what happened at Standing Rock, we look at indigenous communities, we look at working class communities, people who are really on the edge, and the kind of, it's not been a calculation of, am I going to personally benefit from this or not, but we need to take action now. And so I'm very interested also in the way that denial, which I study as a social phenomena, that denial is also related to privilege, that it's particularly prevalent amongst, people who have more a sense of comfort in their immediate lives.
Now, a major thrust of the book that you've written is exploring the specific ways that people find to justify or to not even be aware of their own inaction, and the ways that these justifications or lack of awarenesses are socially encouraged.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, denial is often thought of as a more individual or psychological phenomena, and there's important work that's been done at that level. But I, as a sociologist, think about how we do it collectively. So it matters that I, for example, and all of us listening presumably, live in the United States, which is a country that enormously benefits from oil extraction at the same time as we also pay major costs. But it's very different, for example, than people who are in a, you know, South Pacific island nation that does not benefit and is very directly impacted. The way that their psychology with respect to climate change looks very different. So denial is also social, not only in the reason that we might feel it, but especially how we do it. So as a community, there's things that are normal to talk about and uncomfortable. There are conversation norms, norms of emotion. How afraid, how much fear is it socially acceptable to show publicly before people think you're crazy? You know, these things are social norms that shape then the kinds of reality that we ultimately produce by what we do and don't talk about and share and so forth.
Well, I'm going to encourage our listeners to take a look at the book for a much more detailed and fascinating, again, discussion of the obstacles to activism around the issue of climate change, how that denial actually manifests itself, the different forms that it takes. But I want to move now a little bit to your conclusions as well. One of them, very, very important, of course, is that inaction or apathy, as you explore it, is not simply a natural default.
Absolutely. So I think it's something that when you are aware of a real problem, it's the idea of the elephant in the room being very difficult to ignore, right? If you're aware that something's there, it actually takes work to ignore it. You have to do mental work, change the subject in conversations, turn off the radio when it's playing something you don't want to listen to. These are actual actions. And, you know, so this is, you know, this is also why I talk about it as a socially constructed thing. And underneath that, one of the things that's critical, I mentioned that part of the conversation that I hope to change with the book is that people just need more information. And the other part is that they just need to care more. The reason that people are working to ignore this problem is not because they are greedy and self-interested and don't care, but actually, I believe because we do have a really profound capacity to care. And climate change is the largest material and symbolic threat, certainly that we've had in a very long time, if not ever, in the history of humanity. And that makes it a very difficult thing to confront.
Kari, we're going to have to end this segment of our conversation. I want to mention two things. One is that, of course, you point out in the book that the ongoing conversations that we need are best carried on. They're rewarded, they're reinforced by participating in social movements. This isn't an individual phenomenon, and and can't be overcome individually. And I wanted to mention also that your own activity, I guess we won't have time to explore it now, but your work with the Karuk, with Klamath Native Americans around some of these same issues.
Absolutely. Right now, if anyone's interested in the current issue of Yes Magazine, the guys I work with that are doing a lot to bring fire back to the landscape as a preventative measure, it is incredibly heartening to me to work with people who are coming at things with such vision and being proactive and not just wringing their hands and giving up, but it's a real model for how local communities, there's many things that can be done, and the benefits that all of us bring are received both individually and collectively from really engaging with the climate.
Wonderful. We've been talking with Kari Marie Norgaard. Kari, it's been a pleasure, our contact both before the show and during the program. We'll talk again.
Thank you. Thank you for your work. And everyone, get out in the streets and do things together for the world. It's worth it.
Terrific. That's a great segue to our next person here in the studio with me. Thanks, Kari. Jan Hocken is with me. Jan, you know, is an old mole that I would say is the height of her achievement, but she's also a professor and a psychologist and an author, a filmmaker. But you know her as, of course, the old mole. Jan, you've been reading a lot on the psychological aspect of these same issues. Kari Marie Norgaard outlines a mental landscape where climate change is both deeply disturbing but almost completely submerged. It's simultaneously unimaginable, and yet it's common knowledge. What would a psychologist, and especially a psychoanalytically oriented psychologist, have to say about the phenomenon?
Well, I really appreciate the lines of analysis Carrie's pursuing here, and one, we'd like to start with a couple points and kind of how I would think about them. One is that the calls for action can be as problematic as inaction, that often people will act as a defense against thinking and lingering with disturbing feelings. And a key psychoanalytic idea is that people often, quote, act out or engage in some ritualistic behavior to avoid uncomfortable feelings. And of course, those are important in everyday life, that we can kind of get on with business by doing small things that maybe have ritual meaning. Some say recycling has some of that meaning. It makes people feel they're doing something when it is insignificant given the scope of the problem. And so I think this idea of creating space where people can linger and be thoughtful and feel the support and strength of groups is important, as opposed to individual acts that are, well, ultimately not very helpful. I also think that turning from these very hypercognitive models or models that have to do with providing more information, although that is important, but then turning to the role of emotions is just as complex as the information processing models. And I think that also comes out of Norgaard's work, that there are different ways of thinking about denial, that denial and apathy are not adequate ways of understanding people's seeming lack of responsiveness, that there are a lot of emotional reactions people have that are overwhelming. I think it's useful to think about emotional life as very dynamic, where people can have multiple feelings as well as the deeper kind of emotional substrate that's associated with feeling states, and that some emotions can be very problematic in a movement. And part of one challenge in the climate justice movement, or the global justice movement focused on the climate crisis, is that people often feel terror, and the focus on fear and terror can lead to very short-term and narrow responses.
Terror about the consequences, consequences.
I mean, if you think about this problem at all, their anxiety moves to a state of feeling pretty terrified by the scope of it. And it is terrifying. So, and hard to represent in mind and kind of contain in mind. And yet a lot of how we've evolved with responses to fear and immediate threat are to really narrow the focus. And that is what people do often, something very narrow. And yet we're being called upon to respond to a threat that requires massive global cooperation, large group kind of activity, sustained engagement over time. One concern I have with how the threat of the global climate crisis gets cast through an emotional lens is through a kind of apocalyptic narrative that fits all too readily with fundamentalist movements that welcome the apocalypse. And so I think we have to be just as thoughtful about the emotional life of groups around this issue as we are about the information and the data attached to it.
You've given us some really rich material to respond to explore further. Implicit in how you began is the recognition that inactivity may not be entirely accurate, that there's a lot of activity. The question is the quality of the activity and how responsive it is really to the threat that we do face. That's one issue, and we should explore that further, how we get to an actual strategic understanding of what activity is appropriate. So not just inactivity, but activity that may serve our own psychological needs but not be responsive to the actual threat. Beyond that, there is the emotional life and really how we overcome or how we recognize in the first place the sorts of resistances that people have and how we overcome them to, I mean, there's this quote that you like about first having to analyze resistances before being able to overcome people's defensivenesses around acting.
And I think that is important. So as a therapist, what becomes important is why it's difficult to talk about certain things as much as the thing itself, what the fear and dread is, or what people imagine they'll be called upon to do, or the shame and guilt attached to whatever it is. And I think with the climate crisis, it's similar to other social justice movements, but in other ways, I mean, there are particular communities that are vulnerable, that are living this in a very immediate way. More affluent people can escape its immediate consequences, but ultimately there is this sense that the earth that we all inhabit together is a victim, and the species that we have some human responsibility for are the victims, and that we all share in some guilt around being implicated in this problem. And when you stir up guilt in people about a problem, that can take all sorts of directions. People in general who are confronted with a problem where they feel implicated get defensive. And we all know this from personal life, that guilt has a way of, people don't like to feel bad. They don't like, in general, there is a human defensiveness around that. So I think that is a critical issue, how we talk about both very different levels of responsibility for the global climate crisis, but also recognize there is some part of it that has to do with human destructiveness. So I don't think it's helpful to only rely on psychologies that talk about human positive restorative capacities, which are part of our human repertoire. The desire for meaning, to connect, to be constructive in the world. But there is also, we are hardwired for some aggressiveness that is part of our survival that can turn into destructive activities. And I think finding ways of talking about that and the problem of guilt, while keeping in mind the political difference in the social responsibility for the problem under capitalism, is important. And it's difficult, as anyone who's been involved in social movements know. You know that once you start talking about oppression or a social problem, a lot of feelings get stirred up in people that are difficult to sustain in a group. People either leave or they start accusing other people, that sort of thing. So I think how to handle those group dynamics and to have some compassion for how difficult it is for people.
Just to be clear, in Kari Marie Norgaard's work, we didn't get to this, but underlying her work is a sense that there are particular human drives. There are drives to make sense of the world. There are drives to feel good about oneself. There are drives to create, to find or create meaning in the world. You're adding to that, of course, aggressive drives, negative drives that are components of human makeup. Can you say a word more about how those manifest in, well, vis-a-vis climate change and in resistances to being involved? There's an automatic guilt simply by being part of a society that is destructive.
Yeah, I come out, and this is for another day, perhaps a tradition called Kleinian psychoanalysis, that on the face of it sounds like a more negative view of human nature, because it does place destructiveness at the center of early experience, and that we have to come to terms with our destructiveness, wanting to bite the hand that feeds us, including our own mothers. But the other side of that is the capacity for reparation and curbing our narcissism, coming to terms with our human capacity to hurt others and the world around us. And so I have found that a very meaningful and important line of psychoanalytic thought that has some relevance to the group dynamics of this problem.
And the implications, of course, are vast, reaching well beyond climate change even to the difficulties and the possibilities of a participatory democratic society and all the intervening political steps. We've been talking about climate change in action, people who are aware of problems but don't act on them. This is Norm Diamond from the Old Mole Variety Hour. Jan Hocken has been our guest now, Kari Marie Norgaard earlier. Let's not simply give information to people, but project potential solutions and plausible solutions as we work with people around the issue.
Until the philosophy, which old one race superior and another inferior.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for Memorial Day. Remember, you can find the show, its varied segments, with links to more information available for your podcasting pleasure in a day or two here at KBOO Portland on the Old Mole Variety Hour page, or by following us on Twitter or liking us on Facebook. I'm Fran Michelle. I've been your host today. Many thanks to our engineer, Patricia Kullberg. And thanks to Jan Hocken and Jakob Reisberg for their conversation on Standing Rock. Thanks to Bill Resnick and his guest, John Pfeffer, for their discussion. Thanks to Norm Diamond and Kari Marie Norgaard and Jan again for their conversations about climate change in action. The Old Mole will be back next week on your listener-supported, volunteer-powered community radio station, KBOO Portland. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.